Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape Then Beer.
Hey everyone, Fitz here. Alex has been out climbing because he's Alex, and I've also been out climbing, which is freaking awesome, and it feels good. Like we promised you, we have one final story this year for you, sort of bonus episode that's actually a lot more than a bonus. It's pretty rad. During our work around the Olympics, we stumbled into this ridiculous story that was too good to pass up on. We discovered that the four Americans who went to Tokyo this last summer, technically, they were not the first Team USA. The story starts in the early 1980s. Ronald Reagan is in the midst of a thermonuclear arms race against the USSR known as Star Wars. In mainstream media, Russians are firmly cast as the villains. Think Red Dawn, Ivan Drago against Rocky. In sports, the 1980 Miracle on Ice was still front and center. In the 80s Summer Games in Moscow, the USA boycotted them. In mainstream culture, the idea of like visiting the Soviet Union would seem almost strange. But at that time, climbing was decidedly not mainstream. Today, Alex and I talk with Beth Wald and Russ Klum. In 1986, four climbers, Beth, Russ, Dan Michael, and the legendary Todd Skinner, crossed over the Iron Curtain to go compete in a one-of-a-kind speed climbing competition. The story starts in 1983 in Waco Tanks, Texas. Let's dive in.
You know, basically, we saw somewhere that the your 1986 Soviet speed climbing competition might be one of the first sort of international competitions. We just want to hear the story.
I couldn't get anybody in Minnesota to believe me that there was climbing in El Paso in the winter. So, and nobody was willing to take their Christmas vacation and risk something that was unknown. So I took a Greyhound down and met Todd. This was, I think, in 1983. Who I didn't know very well. I mean, I just climbed with him at the tower a little bit, and I met Todd in Waco, and it turned out to be, you know, amazing. And then Russ showed up that same season, that same winter, that same period while I was there. And they were, I think, you know, I was, like I said, I was just starting to climb and travel a little bit, but, you know, Todd had all these dreams, and Russ had already traveled all over the world climbing, and of course I was super inspired. And I think maybe even I brought up Russia, because I was studying Russian.
In our time of hanging around Waco, we talked about places to visit. We always thought, my God, the USSR, Russia, it's huge. There's got to be some good rock climbing there. And so Beth, who actually spoke and wrote some Russian, she started to investigate for us and quickly found out there is no bloody way that we are going to be able to go to Russia and go rock climbing. It's just not going to happen, especially the way we'd want to do it, which would be like, yeah, let's get a car and just go explore. Ain't happening.
Back in college, I think I just started digging into, and you know, there's no internet, there's nothing. So I just started asking questions and doing reading. And I probably looked at old climbing magazines. I can't even remember exactly how I came across it, but it was like climbing in Russia was very organized. Like everything sport-wise was very organized. It was federized, you know, there were federations and there were clubs, and it was very, very difficult to climb outside of like organized sports because that's just the way life worked there. You know, everything was pretty regimented. You know, I realized that the only way to go to Russia to climb was to go to an official event, and I found out about these speed climbing competitions. And it was going to be held in 1984, but this was like already, you know, winter, probably 1984. So that was off. So the next option was 1986.
And we thought, well, what the hell? That's better than nothing. It'd be kind of interesting to go over there and see what they got. So the big challenge to begin with was figuring out how to go about this. And we certainly found it very quickly that there's no way that we can go without having an official recommendation from our American Alpine Club, or sanctioned that we are the official American rock climbing, speed climbing competition team. And what do we know about speed climbing? Nothing.
But Russ, you know, he knew some of the people at the club. And there was a guy named Jim McCarthy, who was a president, was a friend of his.
I told him our plan, and he went to bat for us, and which wasn't the easiest thing. There were a lot of people on the board of directors that were not psyched about the idea of a U.S. team going to the Russian competition and probably getting crushed, you know, just showing how weak we were compared to the Russians. There was still some Cold War mentality at the time.
Most of the AAC was against competitive climbing. You know, this was the era where even bolting, you know, sport climbing was a huge controversy. You know, kind of the Yosemite free climbing ideal and the freedom of the hill, you know, that was all like the ethics that American climbing, you know, had stood for years.
But Jim managed to convince them that this would be a good thing. So we got permission. So we sent our letter from the American Alpine Club to the Russian Federation. And they said, well, okay, you know, yeah, you guys are invited now.
Outside of the Soviet Union and outside of that competition, we couldn't say we were the U.S. team. We couldn't claim being an official team. We couldn't really talk about it to the press, and we couldn't wear uniforms.
But they did have uniforms, and they are dope. Check out Climbing Gold on Instagram for the photos. They're pretty sweet. So they had an official, unofficial team. Todd was the larger-than-life, hyper-positive Energizer Bunny of the team. He was a cowboy from Wyoming, always looking for the next adventure. Russ, the strong man from the Gunks, pushing the boundaries of physical limits alongside the likes of Lynn Hill and Alan Watts. And Beth, keen for adventure, incredibly creative and strong, and she had just enough Russian language skills to get the team by. Rounding out the group was Dan, the underspoken, quiet strength, who was deemed team coach. In the pre-internet Cold War era, getting to Russia was no easy feat. Visas had to be secured via snail mail, flights had to be booked with long-distance phone calls and travel agents, train tickets booked in other languages. No Google Translate. They chose to go to Czechoslovakia and East Germany first, where they were friends with the East German climber Bert Arnold, and then catch a train to Moscow, where they would be met by their Soviet handler. From there, they'd head to the competition alongside the other national teams. The competition would take place in Yalta, a Russian vacation destination on the Crimean Peninsula in the Black Sea. Russ applied for the team visas with the Russian embassy in D.C., and in the meantime, Todd left early to go to Germany, where he planned to climb ahead of the trip.
I was getting in touch with a woman down in Washington, D.C. at the Russian embassy, and every time I called her up, "You should be getting them soon, Mr. Kluin, no problem, the visas are on their way," but we never had them. And then I got a phone call one morning in early September from Skinner, and it was Skinner making a phone call. You got to pay for phones at the time. It means he has a bunch of change in his hand, plugging it into a machine in West Germany. And he said, "Well, you know, check this out. The Russians have just changed the competition dates. Now it's happening 2 weeks earlier," which at that time meant in about 10 days we had to be there. And I said, "Well, Todd, I don't have the visas yet." He said, "Well, don't worry about it. I mean, hopefully it'll happen. But anyway, we're leaving for East Germany tomorrow, and we're going to climb in with Bert Arnold. So, you know, try and let us know what happens." I was like, this thing's gone. There's no way it's going to happen now. But just as I was that morning after I hung up with Todd, I called up the Russian embassy again, and they said, "Well, you know, still no news." But literally like 5 minutes after that, a FedEx truck arrives at my house, and they have the visas.
Russ, Beth, and Dan launched themselves into the unknown and made their way to Europe, where they met up with Todd and caught a train to Moscow, entirely unsure of what awaited them.
I think it was early in the morning after like taking the train all night to Moscow, and we weren't even sure anybody was going to be there, you know, and we had no idea if nobody was there what we would do. We had maybe like $100 in our pockets, no phone numbers. Plus, you know, there's no way to communicate. And so I remember Todd got off the train and was just like, "Hey, we're here. We're the Americans." And luckily, there was this beautiful young woman named Nina who was there like, to meet us. And she came running over and we were like, "Wow, someone is here to meet." And she was so surprised. She said, "We thought it was a joke that you guys were coming on the train. Why would the American team come on the train?"
Nina, as it turned out, would be the group's state-sanctioned translator for the trip and shepherd them around the country to the competition.
She wasn't like a really our watcher. I think they probably had, we figured there was somebody else that had been assigned to like watch us. You know, everybody who was up from the West was kind of minded to some degree, but she was lovely and fun and not horrified by all of our antics, and we were really happy when we saw her at the train station. Moscow was, I remember it being really gray and cold and dreary, and we were in one of those great big, like, block-like hotels. It was like the Soviet sports hotel for all foreign sports teams that come. And yeah, very Soviet.
Moscow was basically a lot of concrete. And I'm sure it's very different now. It felt like a black and white movie. You know, it was just waiting for Disney to come in and add some color to it.
When you finished telling the story of your speed climbing event in the USSR, I have to tell you my speed climbing competition in Russia as well, because it's eerily similar, even though it's 30 years later.
Did you do that? I didn't know you did that.
It's so similar. It's the same. My flights were a debacle. I showed up a day late. The belaying was insane. We didn't know what was going on. It was all exactly the same kind of thing.
The 7 or 8 international teams, they were shuttled to the sunny limestone sea cliffs of Yalta, where the competition would be held. For the Americans, it was like mostly an experience. But for the other teams, especially the Soviet teams, the stakes of this competition were super high. It was really important to them. And in some cases, it was almost a chance for a better life.
It was a really big deal, you know, for these guys. And it's like the culmination for them. The Russian team had gone through, and I think probably all the other teams, had all these other qualifying events that they had to go to become, they weren't like us just saying, oh, we're going to be the Polish team, you know, or we're going to be the Russian team. They had to qualify and be, you know, to become, to go to the competition, you know, to be on that team. They climbed, they didn't have climbing shoes. And even though they were, you know, they're supported by, you know, this Soviet, you know, once you're on a team, you know, you get some support from the government. But it was really hard for climbers to get climbing shoes from the West. So they had just like rubbers you would wear over a shoe, like a fancy shoe that they got really small, and then they would tie them to their feet and rub rosin on them to make them a little bit sticky.
They had an interview process at the start of the competition for everybody. And when it came time for the Americans, we all went up and, you know, the TV cameras are running and we're like, yes, I'm Russ Cleland, I'm from New York. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. And when Skinner got up there, it was such a made for TV moment. It was like the guy's asking, so Todd, where are you from? And Todd's like, I am from Wyoming. And like, so Todd, where is Wyoming? Wyoming is in the West. And Todd, what do you do in Wyoming? I am a cowboy. And oh God, the crowd just went nuts. It was so, I mean, the cheers went up, you know, no one's going to rival that. It was pretty damn good.
Well, it was held on these, you know, it was held on real rock, like big cliffs, not in a gym. And there was two parts to it, kind of three parts. There was a shorter speed climb, a longer speed climb, and then there was, for the men, one rope team of men was a lead climb, a speed lead climb of, I think it was about 4 pitches, but they were short pitches.
It was a wacky event overall. It went on for, I think it was about 4 or 5 days in total. Belayers were like two big fat dudes with like leather gloves hauling in rope hand over hand. And they lowered you the same damn way.
Like they were just running into the woods holding onto the rope?
No, there were two of them. So like one was pulling in, the other guy was like the backup. It was, and when they lowered you, man, it was a heart-stopping lower. You were going like at the speed of light until the last 3 feet. And each morning, we would be told what today's climb was going to be and what the rules were. And Nina, our translator, would be explaining the rules. And we'd have 1,000 questions like, well, wait a second, there's a boundary line on it. Does that mean can you break the plane of that with a limb and not touch a hold, or do you have to touch a hold? You know, just, it was, you know, one clarification after another. And to the point where like, I don't really know what the hell the rules are, but let's just try and stay inside the boundary. Yeah. And it was, I mean, every morning, you could just imagine a chatter in this kind of cafeteria style room with, you know, the Germans being, you have the German translator, you have the Japanese translator. It's just a cacophony of noise. And nobody, in the end, I don't think anybody but the Russians actually knew what the hell's going on.
Yeah, that's why they're hosting the comp. they're like, it's weird that we win every year and nobody else understands what's going on.
I will say, though, they were fast. Those guys, no one is going to blitz them, that's for sure. I mean, it bears no resemblance to what speed climbing has morphed into at this point, for sure. I mean, I guess the one thing that was kind of cool is at least we were climbing real rock, and the routes weren't that easy. I remember that short top rope was, you know, in the 5.11 range, and longer one was in the 5.10 range. And the multi-pitch, I couldn't even tell you. It was like, just go as fast as you can and pull whatever you want. It was just like, you know, go. But it was definitely nothing like having what the modern speed climbing comp has turned into, for sure.
Yeah, why is speed climbing such a thing in the Eastern Bloc?
You know, if I think, and this goes back to the idea of alpinism and speed is safe. So if you go fast, you're being safe. And they had that competition for I don't even know how long. It had mostly been about it was Eastern European countries. So I think the whole idea was like speed is safety, so therefore you should be able to climb safely if you go fast enough. Even though it seemed just as reckless as possibly be. I think that was really what the impetus was, you know, speed and safety.
the multi-pitch competition that I was at, the way they started and stopped the timers were very specific for, you know, when the second person gets to the ground or whatever. Basically, the person cleaning the pitch didn't have to actually hold on to the gear because that wasn't really part of the competition. So when they cleaned, all they did was just drop the gear to the ground. It was totally insane. So they're multi-pitch climbing, but, you know, in the interest of speed, the second would just drop the hardware and it would all just like land in a pile on the ground, you know, strewn around the base. And then same with pulling the rappel ropes. I think they ended the timer when the rope got down. And so when the second person finished rappelling, they just sprinted into the forest as fast as they could with one end of the rope. Like, instead of pulling the rope like normal, they just ran away. And you know, I was there with my friend Chris Wider. The two of us are watching it like, what? You know, because none of it was so particular to the style of the competition. It's like things that you would never do in real life because they make no sense. But, you know, to win a competition, I guess it works. It was so crazy.
It was definitely the nuttiest thing. In the evenings, we were staying in this kind of grim little, like, hostel thing, but there was this, you know, we're in the Black Sea, you know, we're in the Crimea, so it's a big tourist destination. Well, you know, tourists being basically Russians from Moscow.
The Germans were real rapscallions, like Norbert Sandner. He was like the coach of the team, but he was an old friend. I think Russ knew him from before, and we had met him in Germany before we'd come over, and he was just fun-loving. Great guy. And he was always trying to get everybody, all the teams together to go do things, you know, which was not necessarily part of the official itinerary. And so he got us all in. He convinced the authorities, the kind of our minders, to let us. He's like, oh yeah, last year or 2 years ago when we came, we all got together last night and we went to this disco, this hotel that has a dance place, and they let us go, and like, so we'd really like to do it again, so they let us go. And then he was like, oh, never got to do that last time. So
we on the top floor of this hotel, they had this bar and dance club, so we'd go up there in the evenings and kind of hang out. And our translator Nina was just like, she'd watch us and try and calm us down along with Beth. And like, but one night we just had one or two too many beers, maybe three or four too many beers. And we got onto the dance floor. Pretty much I don't know why it started. We started slam dancing with ourselves, which made us bump into paying customers at the hotel until finally a bouncer said, okay, you guys. Nina said, we have to leave now. There's no, we can't stay. We must leave now.
We ended up getting thrown out. I think we just got a little too raucous. And Nina was pretty horrified by some of that, but she was a good sport.
So we just got tossed, which was fine. But then, but even funnier, so we're with the West Germans. Now we're down in the lobby. And Norbert Sander, one of the West Germans, there's a whole group of tourists coming in off a bus. And Norbert tries to grab a key to one of the rooms in the hotel to stay there. Then at that point, somebody from security bounced us from the hotel for good. We weren't allowed back in at all.
That's how you make a good impression, you know, on the Eastern Bloc. You're like, ah, Americans.
Did you guys win? I mean, like, how did you guys do?
We actually amazingly got third as a team. And I think we might have even gotten second if I hadn't fallen on one of the routes that I did. So I got disqualified from one of the events. So, yeah, which was like, we were just shocked.
We did pretty well. I think Beth had, she didn't have a team route, but she had to do two of those top ropes. And on one of them, for some reason, she was disqualified. I can't remember why. But, you know, they had all kinds of rules about boundaries, whatever. But if she had not fallen on that route, we would have come in second behind the Soviets, which is crazy. As it was, we came in third, but that was, it was good enough. But where we ended up was beside the point. It was just seeing that whole scene and being part of it was just nuts.
My impression of the Eastern Bloc is just sort of grayness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what I actually hear you say is that, you know, maybe you kind of expected that, or like, you know, first glimpse, that's what Moscow was like. But inside of it all, there was a deep vibrancy.
Yeah, and there was a hunger, you know. We did think, you know, East Germany seemed sad and depressed. I think it seemed, because we had been in West Germany, it did seem grayer, but not when we were with the climbers like Bernd Arnold, who was this amazing East German climber, you know, just who really developed the sport there, just insanely good climber. And he's the one who showed us around. And he, you know, he and his friends had found ways to express themselves and to, you know, find life, you know, joy in life and ways to push themselves. And lots of that was, you know, I think one of the reasons, like, the mountaineers that came from that part of the world are so extreme and so incredibly, you know, they push themselves really hard, and it was the same for climbers. You know, that was their outlet, you know, was climbing. And if you got good enough, you could, and you got recognized, you could maybe get a chance to travel a little bit. Like Bernd had been able to go to West Germany and had climbed a little bit outside of East Germany. So even though there was some of that, I don't know, dreariness or just sort of a, you know, a bit of a more depressed, not as vibrant feeling. More so, I remember that more so in East Germany than in Czechoslovakia or Poland. Within the realm and within the homes of these people, it was like a totally different thing. You know, when we were out on the cliff, you know, it was a totally different thing.
I am really, really happy I made trips to the Eastern Bloc prior to the fall of the wall. The thing was, of course, Westerners were a rarity. And what you did discover, though, is when you got inside the beehive of climbers, when you got into the brother and sisterhood of other climbers, it was no different from being anywhere else. You know, everybody was psyched about roots, psyched you're a climber, psyched you're visiting. And frankly, when you came from the States to those places, you were treated like royalty because they were just so unusual to go there. So you were sitting there. It was this really interesting kind of separation of two worlds, because you had the world of the Eastern Bloc and kind of the grimness of that on so many different fronts. It's not just that you have a government that's oppressive and you have to kind of watch what you say, but even what you were able to, you know, purchase, or, you know, what you were able to buy, what was available for consumer goods, where you had to live, the restrictions. It was just, you know, it was so oppressive compared to what you had in the West. But when you got away from that, you got into this little ball of climber union, it was just like being anywhere else. Everybody's just psyched. You have the same love. You have the same passions. You have the same desires to do these things. And I found that so rewarding. And it was just a great experience to have those things happen, especially when you compared it to what their everyday life was like.
if you're a climber, you have a built-in community when you go to foreign places. So you have like people you can connect with on so many levels immediately. And so you're already kind of not a tourist, you know, you're kind of already kind of part of the club. And so you get to see things and have experiences with people. At least this was my impression, you know, knowing what I knew, like the little bit I knew of international tourism, like it was different, you know, we didn't feel like tourists, you know, we felt like we were kind of there on a mission, and we met other people in those countries who had the same mission, and we had these instant connections and kind of deep experiences with them, you know, and that was really amazing. And it was really amazing to have that across these, what would seem to be chasms of politics and culture, you know, just putting a bit of, you know, of humanity on these countries that you just, you know, barely had heard about, or if you had heard about them, they were kind of in these scary contexts. You know, I think it set the stage for trips we did. A trip I did with Todd to Vietnam and another time, and then other trips that I did. I went back to the Soviet Union in 1989, and yeah, it was really, it definitely set the stage, I would say, for lots of things I did in the future, climbing and outside of climbing, you know, who are just exploring the world, kind of first through climbing and then eventually morphed through my camera and photography and storytelling.
Todd would go on to become one of his generation's most famous and talented athletes. Tragically, he died rappelling off a climb in Yosemite in 2006. Russ now helps manage the Shawangunk Preserve, better known as the Land and Access Managers to the Gunks. You can find him climbing there on an almost daily basis. Beth would go on to become a world-renowned National Geographic photojournalist, shooting dozens of stories around the world. Thanks everyone for listening. This bonus episode was written and edited by Andrew Burton, additional editing by Cordelia Zars. Music today by Brendan O'Connell, Amy Stolzenbach, and Cordelia Zars. Alex Honnold is our host, our executive producers, Rebecca Call and Lisi Hendricks for Duct Tape and Veer, and Ben Endy and Jonathan Retzik for RXR Sports. I'm Fitzko Hall. Thanks for listening.